Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Coming up on the show, lawmakers who oppose implementing new taxes to fund education say school finance is too opaque. But districts say there isn't a penny that isn't accounted for.
To the point where you could find out how much do we spend on gasoline mowing lawns at Tongue River High School in Dayton.
We'll take a look at a huge new oil and gas project and what it means for Converse County.
It's going to change the whole nature of our community. It's going to be more traffic and just an awful lot more people.
And food insecurity among students at the University of Wyoming is more common than you might think.
It really does affect their success at university, because who in the world can pay attention when they're hungry?
Plus, tales from a couple who lived with a wolf pack. All that and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. You may have heard a little about blockchain, but if some people in Wyoming have their way, you will learn a lot about it. Because according to these experts, legislation that Wyoming lawmakers are considering this year could open the floodgates for blockchain businesses. Some lawmakers are comparing it to the internet boom of the 1990s and say it could completely change Wyoming's economic future. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
Blockchain has become famous as a safe and fast technology that uses digital or cryptocurrency, which is supposed to be the wave of the future. But it's more than that. It's a smart technology that can identify and fix mistakes, and the multiple systems involved in blockchain allows it to identify hackers and get rid of them. It can be used for all types of data, and it's frankly pretty cool. Blockchain needs a number of developers and data centers for the system to work properly, and Wyoming wants to be a haven for those. The legislature is considering four bills this session that will remove regulatory burdens that will allow blockchain to thrive in Wyoming. The state is racing to do this before other states get on board, so it will become the lead state in the growing technology. Caitlin Long is one of the founders of the Wyoming Blockchain Coalition that is trying to push things forward.
There are so many wonderful aspects of Wyoming already that the industry is interested in, such as zero income taxes and cheap power and a cool climate for those that are running data centers. But we're also trying to define a regulatory environment that's welcoming to businesses.
Explaining what the four bills do is a little complicated, but they will make Wyoming the first state to remove regulations that could hinder a blockchain company's development. Sundance Representative Tyler Lindholm says a lot of states want to use blockchain technology for practical purposes. He wants to go beyond that.
Bring in the blockchain to store their driver's license, those types of things, which I think later on is a good idea. Right now, I think what we need to concentrate on in the state of Wyoming is getting those companies, those industry pioneers, we need to get them to Wyoming.
You might be skeptical, but Long and others say there is a lot of interest in what Wyoming is doing. A quick Google search shows a number of articles in trades and elsewhere about what the state is up to. But more importantly, Long and the coalition are hearing from entrepreneurs. She says the first state that clears the way will benefit from it the most. One company is already set up here, and others say they are on the way if the legislation passes.
Let's bring jobs into Wyoming. Let's bring more revenue into Wyoming. There's no fiscal impact on these bills, so let's throw some spaghetti up against the wall. Let's make it a welcoming regulatory environment. I think we may have an embarrassment of riches. I don't think we'll have a problem of no folks coming here if these bills pass.
House Majority Leader David Miller expects banks to push back because they stand to lose initially, but he's been following the issue for a while and is convinced that Wyoming needs to be all in.
You talk about diversification, diversifying our economy. To me, this is probably the best real chance we have to do it without being too disruptive in the taxation sector to Wyomingites.
Once again, the reason it's so popular is that it's a safe way to store all sorts of data and prevent hacking. Former University of Wyoming President Dick McGinnity teaches business at the university and is a longtime entrepreneur. He says he sold.
It may not have the equal economic effect that the internet has had, but it's going to have something in the same league anyway.
That's because of all the things it can be used for.
Because it'll make processing of transactions, of titles, of voter registration records, of healthcare records so much more efficient and so much more accurate. That's where the benefit will come from.
Representative Miller says there will be money for the state on business filings alone, but getting those involved in the blockchain technology side would be huge. He says the challenge now will be to get this complicated concept through the legislature. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Wyoming lawmakers have mixed reactions to the sweeping federal budget proposal President Trump released this week. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story on what the document means and doesn't mean for our state.
Donald Trump may be president, but Wyoming's Mike Enzi chairs the Senate Budget Committee. And, according to the Constitution, that gives Enzi a tad more power in the budget debate than any occupants of the Oval Office. Enzi thanks the president for his proposal.
I thought it was a good list of suggestions.
See, there's a secret about presidential budgets. Whether Republicans or Democrats are in charge, lawmakers of all stripes hate them. Enzi says he's now got the hard job of taking the lead on writing the nation's actual budget for next year.
It's just a list of suggestions. Congress is in charge of the spending.
The odd thing about this year's annual budget tango between the White House and Congress is that just last week lawmakers reached an agreement for a sweeping two-year budget deal that added an extra $360 billion to what the nation was supposed to spend. Enzi didn't like when I insinuated that the deal had his support.
Now, wait a minute. Don't say you guys.
Yes, sir.
Pardon I'm the budget chairman. I'm a little appalled at what that passed.
In fact, Enzi voted no. As an accountant and the budget chair, Enzi's top concern is the ballooning $20 billion national debt. And he's not alone in being frustrated that his party leaders agreed to Democrats' demands to hike domestic spending in exchange for his party's demands for increased military spending. But as for Trump's budget, Enzi says it was useful for his job of representing folks back home.
It also alerted me to some things I'll have to defend on behalf of Wyoming.
By that, Enzi means the perpetual fight to keep the money from Wyoming's abandoned mine funds in the state.
Yeah, they're kind of specialized. They're paid into by the Wyoming companies, and the money is allocated by law back to us, but it's been difficult keeping that stream going.
Now to the vision for energy policy Trump laid out. His budget calls for drastically reducing research funding for next-generation fuel sources at the Department of Energy, while also lopping some 30% off the top of the EPA's budget. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney supports overhauling and drastically cutting the budget at the EPA.
I think an awful lot of the mandate of the EPA is now being done at the state level, and I think it's usually done better at the state level.
Cheney says she especially likes that Trump is calling for streamlining the environmental review process for things like roads and bridges.
When you look at how we can streamline some of the environmental regulations and permits, when you look at ways that you can, you know, centralize it so you don't have to get permitting done from multiple agencies, I think that's all for the better, and I think that could have a huge impact economically.
While Senator Enzi hates the budget deal, Cheney was able to stomach it because it hiked spending on the military, and she's glad Trump's budget follows suit.
And I think that the president's budget is good from the perspective of the defense numbers. I think, you know, I feel good about where we are now here in terms of the two-year budget deal that we agreed to. It had far too much spending than I would have liked ideally.
There's a handful of Tea Party-backed members of Congress who don't think Cheney's logic flies. Here's Republican Congressman Tom Garrett of Virginia.
Well, we voted against it for a reason. I think it's a little bit hypocritical to decry profligate spending when President Obama's in the White House and not stand on that same soapbox when it's a different president.
But Cheney says increasing military spending was more important than her desire to slash spending on federal programs here at home, which is called domestic spending and includes agencies like the EPA and Department of Education.
Given the crazy system we have, in order to get the numbers for the Defense Department that are absolutely crucial, we had to agree to higher domestic spending.
Now back to Senator Enzi, the Senate Budget Chair. He's helping craft the details of that budget deal that he hates, and his deadline is towards the end of next month, but he doesn't have the details finalized yet.
What timeline?
Yeah.
as soon as I can get it done.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Next, we'll hear about the need to update the U.S. nuclear arsenal. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. U.S. Air Force Major General Don Alston was in charge of the nation's Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Force at F.E. Warren Air Force Base and is considered an expert on nuclear deterrence. He's currently a consultant on the issue and lives in Cheyenne. Major General Alston joins Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to discuss a recent review of the nation's nuclear system and what needs to be done to prepare the country for some new threats. Alston says a recent report indicated that the nation is facing some challenges.
That's the most important part of this nuclear posture review, is to establish how different the world is since 2010, the last nuclear posture review. And of course, over these years, things have changed so dramatically in those 8 years. Russia has been very belligerent and aggressive and has gone into eastern Ukraine, ultimately took territory in the form of Crimea, used nuclear weapons to threaten several nation states. They threatened Poland, Saudi Arabia, Denmark, and Turkey with nuclear weapons. And he rolled out a series of his levels of leadership to remind everyone that they're a nuclear weapons heavyweight and that all should be concerned and weigh their reactions with care. China has continued to be very aggressive in the South China Sea. They've been building islands with runways and ports on these. They've just piled up material on top of coral reefs. And so they're extending their reach and legitimacy from their perspective, which has been very challenging to the nations in the region. They've also continued to modernize their nuclear capabilities, just as Russia has. And in fact, now the Chinese are developing a nuclear heavy bomber, which would give them a triad, like the Russians have always had. And then, of course, North Korea and how the number of nuclear tests that they've done, the number of the development of their long-range missile capability. And then, of course, there's Iran, where there's still a lot of consternation and concern, even with the agreement that we've got, because they're still developing long-range missiles, even if they are not taking additional steps with their nuclear weapons program.
When you look, I mean, one of the topics of conversation that certainly came up with that was what's our capability now? How do we need to modernize things? What's your take on that? I mean, what needs to happen?
Well, the current force that we have is aged and continuing to age. So we already have a program underway to begin the replacement of all of our nuclear capabilities. And then to tie it all together, we have to modernize our nuclear command and control. So that's the size of the challenge we have. But what the NPR, the Nuclear Posture Review, reiterates and fortifies is the value of having a triad. It is so expensive for any adversary to try to defeat any one of those legs of the triad, but when you aggregate them, their capability is dominating. And it also enables the president, if he ever felt a need that the U.S. had to respond with a hostile nuclear weapon in a hostile way, that he would be able to achieve that because of how difficult it is to defeat that weapon system and how expensive it is.
How has the world changed? It seems like we would like things to be a little more mobile than we have them right now. And is that something, as you update things, that you'll be looking at?
It's a great question. And when you look at our potential adversaries, our competitors, you'll see that Russia and China have for a long time had mobile ICBMs. And so they're very difficult for us to track and to target and hold at risk. And it's important for us to be able to do that. We have a force size to match, if you will, or to answer the challenge of a comparably sized Russian force. But you have to be able to hold these military targets at risk. And so it's a great challenge. So I don't know that we'll do that. But what I do think is important is that with ballistic missiles, we have the technology to intercept ballistic trajectories. We can do it on a small scale right now. I think we're pretty competent at onesie-twosies, but large scale, certainly we are not. But over the decades, more nations are going to have that capacity, and so ballistic trajectories are going to be, I predict, defeatable, in which case even the reentry systems that we have on our ballistic missiles may have to have some maneuver capability in order to maintain the credibility of the deterrent. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we'll see that. The Russians and the Chinese are already pursuing maneuvering vehicles on top of their ICBMs.
I am curious, as somebody who reads the news every day, what is our deterrent capability? I mean, can we shoot a lot of these things out of the sky?
We do have a ballistic missile defense capability on the west coast of the United States. We have some assets in Alaska, and we have some assets in California as well. But this is very limited. We're talking dozens. And then we have a doctrine which is, you know, if you see an incoming weapon, the last engagement you want to do is with these final shots on the west coast of the United States. So forward deployed on surface ships that the Navy operates, we have also have interceptors. They're on a missile called the Standard Missile 3. And those forward deployed would be, you know, plan A would be to defeat these missiles while they're in the boost phase and be able to eliminate them before they get close to the nation. But we do have that additional capability back on the West Coast. But you're not going, if you just see one of them coming in, you're going to want to use, you know, more than one probably to take a best shot, see how well you did, have some in reserve to shoot again. Yeah. And so it's a limited capability, it's a competent capability, but more work continues to be done on that.
Do you suspect the attack would be on the United States right here on the homeland, or do you suspect it would be bases or something like that?
Well, when you look at the size of the nuclear forces of competitors and adversaries, you know, you look at North Korea, they have such a small amount, and we have no idea what the accuracy with these right. weapons are. And so they have no intention to hold the ICBM force at risk. So the only thing that they can do with such a limited force is to try to hold population centers at risk. And frankly, the same thing with the Chinese. They are improving their accuracy, but once again, they have a relatively small force compared to the United States and Russia, for example. And so the only deterrent effectiveness that they're trying to leverage is their capacity to hold city population centers at risk.
One last thing before I let you go, just to get away from those weapons and talk about cyber attacks. I know that's suddenly gotten on everybody's radar, and it looks like we've been attacked by both North Korea and Russia. Intelligent people might come to that conclusion. I'm kind of curious how we're ready, and I think some people are very concerned about what that looks like right now.
Well, and this nuclear posture review talks to large-scale attacks on infrastructure and how, you know, we need to reserve all of our capabilities to deter those kinds of attacks because of the precipitating effects that a cyber attack can have. But it's so hard with forensics mm-hmm. to tell in near term exactly what's in real time, exactly what's happening. So it's a very substantial threat. And it is a domain that we have been fighting in now for quite some time. So, you know, we think of it in terms of what about our electric grid? What about our banking systems? How secure are they? I think they're nobody's more fortified, I think, than perhaps the banking industry. But nonetheless, we can all imagine the devastation that can be precipitated by an effective cyber attack, a large-scale impact across the country. And when you think power, I've only seen it in movies, so I haven't seen real data, but you wonder what the precipitating effects would be if we lost power, what time of year, and after you think about hospitals, there's all kinds of other things you would be concerned about, and it could cause large-scale harm to the population, if not many deaths. And we say explicitly, we clarify in the nuclear posture review, that attacks on space assets, attacks on cyber that can have devastating consequences to our infrastructure and our population is something that it's a place you don't want to go if you are a peer competitor. So it's putting a stick in the ground, but it is a space that I know our senior leader, national leadership, is very concerned about how to secure that battle space and defend the country. So a lot of activity going on there. Can't tell you how good we are at that right now. I think that by evidence of sentence structure in the nuclear posture review, we have concerns.
Major General Alston, very fascinating discussion. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Coming up, how lawmakers could be more forthcoming in education funding and the struggle of college kids just to get a square meal. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. In his State of the State address, Governor Matt Mead urged the legislature to find ways to stabilize education funding, which relies heavily on revenues from the energy industry. But attempts to diversify the tax base to protect school finance from booms and busts have gone nowhere. Lawmakers who oppose generating new revenue sources say school finance is too opaque. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson takes a closer look.
As the Wyoming legislature wraps up the first week of the budget session, nothing has been done to heed Governor Mead's call to find a long-term funding solution for education. An improved outlook for the energy industry has taken some of the heat off, but nothing has been done to address what happens next time there's a bust.
I can tell you this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and our problem funding K-12 education is not going away this year. We've got an ongoing problem.
Senator Hank Coe has been trying to corner the gorilla for the last year. He chairs the Education Committee as well as the School Finance Recalibration Committee, which paid consultants $800,000 to examine the school funding model. They told lawmakers not to make cuts. So the gorilla made appearances over in Revenue Committee meetings too, where lawmakers considered a wide range of tax options, including raising sales and property taxes to generate more money for education. But most of those ideas died in committee, and the rest have been rejected by the legislature. Cheyenne Senator Afy Ellis, who serves on the Revenue Committee, says most tax measures failed because she and others had too many questions about how districts spend state-allocated money to ask Wyomingites to pitch in.
I need to be able to look them in the eye and say, we've looked at every which way possible to make sure that your tax dollars are being used efficiently in schools, and I don't think we've gotten there.
Ellis also serves on the Senate Education Committee. She says part of what makes school finance murky is the state's block grant funding model. There's a formula to determine how much each district should get, but she says once districts get the money, administrators, with approval from their school board, spend it how they see fit.
So when we're looking at trying to find ways of making responsible cuts, it's very difficult because we often hear, well, we don't actually use the money allocated for that purpose. We use it for this. And so it makes it very difficult for us to make cuts that won't impact classrooms because those dollars are, who knows how they're being spent.
And while figuring out district expenditures is not as easy as asking Google where to get a cup of coffee, it's also not quite as mysterious as Ellis makes it seem.
Every year, we do examine school districts' expenditures versus the way the model allocates and resources.
That's Jed Ciccarelli, who oversees school finance for the Wyoming Department of Education. He says the CREW report, which stands for the Continued Review of Educational Resources in Wyoming, is available on the department's website going back 10 years.
We can tell you each of the 48 school districts what they're spending on instruction. How does that compare on a per student basis to districts of the same size? So if you're interested in what your district's spending on admin, you can benchmark that a little bit to some other school districts that are the same size.
Ciccarelli says you can look at all sorts of spending categories, from fuel usage to supplies and materials. And if you're interested in transactional level data, that's available through the districts.
That's where I think the local control aspect really comes into play. That's probably why you have school districts that are required to have those approvals by the Board of Trustees for these expenditures so that there is some oversight.
Districts are required to make budgets, salaries, and purchases over $500 publicly available. And school board meetings are open to the public.
That would be a venue to bring up questions or challenges to our budget.
That's Marguerite Herman, who serves on the school board for Laramie District 1 in Cheyenne. Herman says while school board members have ongoing conversations about efficiencies, she can't remember the last time a member of the public showed up to a meeting to scrutinize the budget. Janine Bay Teske from Teton One says it's similar in her district.
We would love for people to come to our school board meetings and ask those kinds of questions, but people just don't come.
So while lawmakers searching for places to make cuts say they'd like more transparency, it doesn't seem like Wyomingites are expressing those same concerns on the local level. And Brian Farmer from the Wyoming School Board Association says he's not sure legislators' concerns were shaped by their constituents.
It does not appear to me that that is a widespread or organically driven position so much as something pushed by an interest group.
A campaign called Open the Books, based out of Burr Ridge, Illinois, recently launched a Transparency Before Taxes campaign in Wyoming. Jeremy Smith, business manager for Sheridan School District No. 1, says nothing about his budget is secret.
There is not a penny that's unaccounted for, nor is there a penny that's not transparent, to the point where you could find out how much do we spend on gasoline mowing lawns at Tongue River High School in Dayton.
And he says the problem might actually be that there's too much information and not enough done to make it digestible.
I do blame ourselves. We don't spend enough time explaining that succinctly enough to our patrons. So we could do a better job of that.
At the state level, the WD is working to make its databases more user-friendly. In fact, the department has to in order to comply with the new federal Every Student Succeeds Act. Those changes are expected to come online next fall. In the meantime, Jeremy Smith says you can always reach out to your district's business manager if you have questions. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
The University of Wyoming is known for being one of the most affordable four-year colleges in the country. That's one argument the school hopes to make to potential students as it pushes to increase enrollment. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder reports, new data about undergraduates' access to food shows how, even at a bargain price, students are struggling to cover all of their expenses.
Jeanette Nadir Mamedova, a senior at the University of Wyoming, invites me into her apartment two blocks from campus. It's just a couple of rooms, but there are paintings on every wall. She's been cooking pasta and offers me some as we sit down at a wooden table edging her kitchen and the stairway. Nadir Mamedova came to Wyoming from Turkmenistan to study environmental science, and she has since added a second major in religious studies, plus two minors. She also works two jobs.
Because we're international students, we're only allowed to work 20 hours a week on campus, not even off campus.
Her paycheck has to cover rent, food, and tuition, which is highest for international students. And her status gives her fewer options for financial aid.
Yeah, so I don't know how I'm going to pay my next semester. It's a lot of money. I'm tired. Yeah. It's like another huge stress.
She's barely making ends meet. She sometimes gets free food from nonprofits and usually cooks from whole ingredients because she's passionate about sustainability and using less packaging. She says that actually saves her money, but still, she is just surviving. Living so far from her family has forced her to be less shy about her problems.
I was very hesitant to, like, approach people and ask for help. Nowadays, I'm like, bleh, saying everything.
Nadir Mamedova is not the only student who's stressed about necessities like food. Last year, Cole Emke of UW's Agricultural and Applied Economics Department helped arrange a survey of financial wellness among undergraduates. One section focused on students' access to food.
If we total low food security and very low food security, both of those were at 18.7%, so 36, 37%, a little more than a third.
More than a third of students are food insecure, and that's just undergraduates. Food insecurity is a term the United States Department of Agriculture uses to describe the broader picture surrounding hunger, including all the stress and health impacts of not knowing whether you'll have enough food. So some students are stressed about getting food, and others are actually missing meals. These numbers match schools all over the country, even those with higher tuition and living costs. Emke says this data is concerning.
It really does affect their success at university, both the money management and food security, because who in the world can pay attention when they're hungry?
Students can take some comfort in the thought that once they graduate, they'll have better chances of making good wages in the future. But that isn't a given.
This is a critical time for these people in their life.
Mike Verkaterin is the director of Interfaith Good Samaritan, the organization that runs the local food pantry. He says he's seen a few students come through, not many, but he does see university staff, and he can think of several people who were students, left before graduating, and are still struggling.
There's a whole population of students that are on the edge of dropping out. I can think of countless people that just they can't afford to stay in school.
There are other organizations in town working to make food more accessible. Feeding Laramie Valley grows and distributes produce and offers garden space. Laramie Soup Kitchen provides community meals on weekdays and has a deal with the university that allows them to take some of the leftover food from events and dining. But according to staff at each of these organizations, not many students are taking advantage of this. Vice President of Academic Affairs Ann Alexander says these resources are wonderful, but there's a stigma in using them.
Study after study after study recently has shown that college students, and particularly students who come from rural backgrounds, will not take advantage of community resources as much as you might expect that they would, frankly, out of a sense of shame, almost.
She and Demke point to money management as a way to address food insecurity. That's part of the intent of a course administrators are piloting next year. It'll be required for incoming freshmen and focused on
time management, stress management, financial wellness, but also getting folks acquainted with resources on campus like study abroad and things like that.
In Nadir Mamedova's case, such a course may not help much. Even if she were just starting at UW, she transferred from community college, so she may not have to take it. And she says she's already careful about managing her time and money.
Thankfully, because of my major, I think, I kept my certain behavior in terms of like sustainability, lifestyle, sleeping schedules, dietary, everything, just like I did in my home country, which is nice, I think.
People at UW have tried to put a food pantry on campus before, and in response to this study, staff and administrators are talking about picking up those efforts. It will likely be a part of the strategic plan for student affairs, but it could take more than a year to actually implement something, and Nadir Mamedova and many others in her same position will have graduated by then. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Alana Elder.
Northern Wyoming might have hundreds of wolves now, but in the early 1990s, there were only a handful. So National Geographic commissioned a husband and wife photography team to take a creative approach. They raised the pack from pups and lived in the wilds of Idaho amongst them. I spoke with Jim and Jamie Dutcher about their new book on what they learned from the Sawtooth Wolf Pack. Jim says his inspiration for the project came from a visit to Wyoming as a kid.
I grew up in Florida, and my father took us on a trip out west, and this was 1956, and taken up into the mountains, and it was incredibly different than Florida. And I just wanted to be a part of the ranch and started volunteering, and eventually had a job as a wrangler there. And it was one time while I was out looking for strays that I came upon my first wolf, and that sort of stayed with me, and the excitement of it all and how curious the animal was. But 30 years later, working for National Geographic and making films about wildlife, I traveled back to that ranch and went for a hike and spotted my second wolf. And at the time, I was looking for a new subject for a new film, and that sort of made the connection.
One of the sections in the book is about the value of leadership to wolves. I wonder if you can describe Kamat. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, Kamat. Even as a puppy, Kamat was very confident. We would bottle feed the pups, and if you picked up one pup and bottle fed, the others would sort of mill around and be in a little huddle. But if you let Kamat go free, he would go out and explore. He didn't care.
And I wonder if you can explain why it is that oftentimes it is the alpha, male or female, that is killed in any situation, either by hunting or when a pack encounters danger.
Yeah, the alpha sees the perceived danger and is the first to stand up to it. And they're usually larger also. And they make a good target for someone who wants to have a trophy animal. And when you destroy that leadership, then the pack really doesn't know how to behave. If you kill all the leaders, then you have just delinquent youngsters that don't know where to cross the rivers, don't know how to make a kill on a very large animal. And what they do, sadly, is they go after livestock because they're desperate. So shooting wolves just really makes it worse for ranchers. It's better to know the pack that's in the area and adjust your ranching techniques to accommodate that. And then you can avoid conflict.
And can you tell the story of the rise of the alpha female? She wasn't really a natural leader in the same way that Kamatz was she?
Yeah, our alpha female's name was Shamook. And, you know, as a puppy, Shamook really was more reserved and kept to herself. And we thought, wow, you know, she could really end up being the omega female, or lowest female in the ranking. But nature always has surprises, and you can't predict wolf behavior. And it turned out that that Shamook came into estrus first, and Kamatz keyed in on her, and he bonded with her, and she became the alpha female. And where Kamatz was a very benevolent leader, Shamook was on the other end. She was much more aggressive, and she was always picking on all the wolves, and very aggressive towards our omega wolf, Lakota.
Well, Lakota, he was a very shy wolf. The pack would kind of push him aside and keep him from eating when they ate, and he would eat last. And so he was often picked upon. But he had a way of getting around this, and that was through initiating play. And he would be the instigator of a game of tag or chasing through the forest and pulling tail and such. But there was another wolf that befriended him. And that was the beta wolf. And we noticed over and over again that this wolf would break up fights when Lakota was being dominated by another wolf and they were feeding. This beta wolf would sometimes body check the other wolves and break up the fights. And these two became friends. And we would often see the two playing together. They just leaped side by side. They were just incredibly close.
I wonder if you could tell me the end of the story for the Sawtooth Pack. After you guys were done with filming, then it was time for them to go and move on to something more permanent. Can you talk about what you decided to do there?
At the end of the project, we made arrangements with the Nez Perce tribe in northern Idaho to create a similar situation, a bigger enclosure where people could come and see the wolves. Then they became ambassadors, as really had done during our films. And they taught humans what wolf packs are all about, and they lived out their lives at this new enclosure near Winchester, Idaho, and I think they did an awful lot of good.
We made a point to release the pups first so that the pack would see that they were all okay and they could focus on the pups. And then we released Kamatz, who went straight over to the pups and made sure they were all right. And we let Lakota, the omega, out last. And it was incredibly, incredibly touching. When we opened the crate for Lakota, he wouldn't come out. He was afraid. And Kamatz, the alpha, his brother, saw that his brother hadn't come out. And he went back over to the crate, and they whined back and forth for several minutes. And then Lakota finally came out, and they both walked shoulder to shoulder into the meadow. And it was so touching, and it really was really what a wolf pack is all about. They wouldn't leave each other behind.
We've been speaking with Jamie and Jim Dutcher, authors of The Wisdom of Wolves, Lessons from the Sawtooth Pack. Thank you both so much for sharing your stories today.
Thank you, Melody. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Jim says there's no longer a Sawtooth Pack, but until they all passed away, the Dutchers visited often, and the wolves were always ecstatic to see them. You can see photos of Kamatz and his pack at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Ahead, we'll wrap up the show talking to a woman ice climber and hear how a new energy project could affect Converse County. County. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Converse County saw an energy boom less than 5 years ago, and it changed the nature of the community with a flood of new activity. While that's since died down, the county is already gearing up for another huge oil and gas project. So, what can the people of Converse County expect with another rush to action? Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
In northern Converse County, a semi-truck is pulling onto a highway from a rig site, rocking back and forth as 49-mile-an-hour sustained winds blow west. Many other trucks are parked in the lot, some carrying oil, gravel, water, and rig supplies. All of this oil and gas activity is on Jay Butler's ranch.
Well, I'm Jay Butler, and my great-grandfather, Tom Robinson Sr., came to Converse County in 1916.
Butler says the rise of oil and gas drilling has changed his life here. His 18,000 acres are now dotted with natural gas pipelines, oil storage tanks, and well pads. He says it didn't used to look like this.
5 years ago, it would have been just a dirt two-track road coming into that with no traffic, with a pickup driving through this pasture, you know, very, very sporadically. The human use is much, much greater today than it was.
In 2013, oil production began to spike. By 2014, it had risen 269% in just 2 years. The town was inundated with crews from Oklahoma and Texas. Butler remembers that every motel, restaurant, and grocery store was full.
You go to the Wyoming State Fairgrounds, and the campground was clear full of fifth wheels and motorhomes.
That boom abruptly ended in 2015, and the value of tax received from oil and gas dropped almost 60% in the county. But now, just 3 years later, locals are already talking about the next boom, one with a lot more proposed wells. I asked Butler how he feels about that.
A little nervous. Sure.
Why is that?
Well, I think if it's this busy and this much traffic today with this amount of oil activity, if it jumps many, many fold, it's going to change the whole nature of our community.
All this isn't happening overnight. Back in 2014, five companies proposed 5,000 new wells to the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. Chesapeake, Anadarko, Devon, EOG Resources, and SM Energy want to develop over the next 10 years on 1.5 million acres. At the end of this January, the BLM released the project's draft environmental impact statement, or EIS, opening up a public comment period for 45 days. The document covers the project's potential impact to socioeconomics, wildlife, water sources, and much more. Jim Willicks, a Converse County commissioner, has been part of a group discussing the project for years. He says it's a big deal.
This is the first time that we've experienced something to this scale.
Construction and jobs for the project could begin as early as January of next year, when the BLM delivers its final record of decision. Willicks explains what it could mean for Converse County economically by looking back at the boom in 2014.
When you increase employment and increase activity in community, those things absolutely go up. Sales tax numbers were at record levels from that oil and gas, so that allowed us to do some capital investment in the county. Low unemployment, and anybody that wanted a job was able to get a job.
Willick says this could be huge for the community. According to the draft EIS, employment from this project area would reach nearly 8,500 jobs by year 10, though that number depends on energy prices.
All right. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Caught up.
Converse County Treasurer Joel Schell watched the rush of new revenue and jobs a few years ago, and he warns the increase doesn't happen in a bubble. Back then, the cost of living rose 9% above the statewide average.
You can't hire teachers because there's nowhere for them to live.
Crime went up 7% with a larger population. Local emergency room numbers shot up.
Or you can't keep restaurants open because you can't find workers.
Though there was more money in the town's coffers, much had to be spent on new issues, like worse roads from the extra traffic.
There's always strings attached. So, you know, one of those, the old bumper sticker is, pray for another boom, we promise this time we won't waste it, kind of thing.
And with a new project this time around, head of the Powder River Basin Resource Council, Jill Morrison, is worried about a different kind of transformation for Converse County, a negative one.
If it goes really fast, it's going to be a wreck. We have to be able to control the pace of development so that it does not overwhelm the infrastructure that we have.
Morrison says the county will be left with difficult-to-plug orphan wells once the drilling is over, due to the extra deep and long wells. The project's new roads, power lines, pipelines, and traffic could also impact the land. An Audubon Society expert says this project overlaps with some of the most challenged sage-grouse populations, particularly affecting sensitive breeding habitat. These are just a few of the potential issues. In the end, Morrison is looking for prudence.
If we want to do this right, it's going to take some very serious planning and some very serious upfront efforts to help reduce these impacts.
The project's benefits and impacts will likely change as public comments come in, policy shifts, and the market changes. Public meetings for the project will occur February 20th through the 22nd in Douglas, Casper, and Glen Rock. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Last weekend was the 20th Cody Ice Climbing Festival. The festival features nightly speakers and ice clinics. Angela Van Wermerch, a professional ice climber, has been climbing for over 5 years, and she teaches many all-women classes. She spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska about how she got introduced to ice climbing and how the sport is becoming more attractive to women.
I was leaving California, and I was hitchhiking out of Truckee, and I got picked up by somebody who does his summers rock climbing guiding and does his winters in the mountains in Colorado. He told me about a town called Ouray, Colorado, and it's like an epicenter for ice climbing. And I had seen it in National Geographic, and it seemed like something I wanted to try. So I bought a bag full of used gear and hitchhiked over to Colorado, and I didn't have any experience rock climbing, but everybody there climbs, and I was really keen. So I made it known that I was new to town. I was looking for climbing partners, and I was really excited to get out there. And nobody would climb with me because I was a newbie. And somebody saw me doing it a couple days in a row, and they were like, "What are you doing? Like, do you want to get on a rope with us?" And I was super excited, and I said yes, of course, and I ended up climbing with this group of people for a couple of days.
What is so fascinating about ice climbing? Like, why did you not give up?
It's always changing, and it's always forcing me to manipulate, like, my body to work with it. It's not something that, like, you walk up to and you decide, like, oh, I'm going to climb this. This is what I'm going to do. It's actually, like, you have to read the ice. If the ice is brittle, you have to tap. And if the ice is sticky, you can swing hard, and you know, if it's bulbous, you have to kind of swing around that. And I love that it kept me fully engaged. And when I was climbing, I couldn't really think about anything else. I was in deep focus.
How would you describe ice climbing to someone who's never done it before?
It is abstract and yet entirely visceral. You know, like you feel the swings and they reverberate into your arm and they kind of like get into your chest. And it's inspiring and wild and it's delicate and fickle. I mean, it really embodies such a wide spectrum of characteristics, but I think that's why I like it so much.
And what's the most challenging thing?
I think managing fear and being rational with it is probably one of the biggest challenges for me, because there's an accepted risk when you go out climbing. You're not allowed to fall when you ice climb. And so constantly having that in your brain, like if it's not an option, it's a good thing. It keeps you safe. But it also can be like, oh my gosh, but like I'm tired, or this is steep. I haven't fallen, knock on wood. I hate even saying it. When I say it out loud, it makes me just cringe.
What were you doing at the Cody Ice Fest?
So I've been teaching clinics at Ice Fest for a handful of years now. And Cody Ice Fest, I was there teaching, and I was just there to get people excited about ice climbing. I had a couple classes, but I had one that was really cool. It was all female class, and I like loved it.
You've trained a lot of women. Are there a lot of women ice climbers out there?
You know, there's not a huge number of people doing it at like a higher level, but I see that changing. And I've seen the perspective on ice climbing change dramatically, and it's actually interests so many women. Like at the Cody Ice Festival, we actually had more women there than men.
Yeah, so do you make a point to teach women when you're doing training classes?
You know, it's funny. I usually get signed up for them because I'm the only chick. But as it's happened, I've learned that those classes give me the most back. I come back so psyched after my female classes because all those women are like me. Like there's, you know, I was out there. I wanted to do it. I didn't know how to get into it. And I just, like, went to Uray by myself, surrounded by men. And I was like, please, somebody teach me. And all the women in my class were just like that. They had been hiking on their own and doing backpacking trips. They all have this adventurous mentality, and they haven't had people to do it with. So teaching a group full of women that were all psyched, I was like, hey, girls, exchange phone numbers. These are your chicks. It was really encouraging. It was just super cool. And that happens, like, all the time when women get together.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
There you can sign up for our podcast. You can also subscribe via Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
If you're a subscriber and have a minute, we'd appreciate it if you'd rate it and write a comment. Anna Rader is our web editor.
If you have a good story idea, you can submit those through our Facebook page or on our website. And if you haven't liked our page yet, be sure to do that while you're there too.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.